Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the Fireside Room, Gary Simpson is speaking on science and religion again. So let's listen in on Gary Simpson.
What I'm going to pick up on today, my title today was called Science and Religion Again, or something like that, and that was because I didn't have enough time to really think. They asked for these, I thought they just wanted an overall title, so the overall title was The Good Society. So I threw down Science and Religion Again. Again, if I had to redo the topic, I'd call it Science and the Sacred, comma, and then Power and Money. Now, we may not get the Power and Money, in which case we'll do it tomorrow. Science and the Sacred, Power and Money. But I'll start off with Science and the Sacred. And it has to do with religion. Traditionally, religions have functioned like, I'll use the metaphor, like a sacred canopy. In people's lives. All over the world and for the history of humankind. I can't see that very well. A sacred canopy. That's the image we'll use. And one of the reasons to use that is because in the book of Genesis, it starts off, it says God creates the heavens and the earth. And what does God do? He stretches the firmament. And the firmament was a, the idea of the firmament was like this big canopy, a huge giant tent. Yeah, right. That came out of Missouri Synod, so I won't do that conversation. The sacred canopy is this image of the firmament is this image of a huge canopy. And last night I went out, and I was out there at 10:30 last night, and I looked up, and you can see this huge canopy. And you can even see the Milky Way, and it looks like a giant canopy, and it has holes for water, and there's water on one side, and water on the other. Kind of the image, of course. But religion also functions and like a sacred canopy. What do you need a canopy for? Protection from
elements,
all kinds of elements, huh? So it's protection. It also has the note of being over the totality of life. And mostly sacred canopies in most religions, including Christianity, run and extend by story, sacred stories. And how do you learn the sacred stories? Orally. And how does that happen? Where do you learn them?
From your grandparents.
Might do it then. There's a time when usually the whole community, which is under this sacred canopy, all gets together, right?
Sermons,
church, liturgy,
festivals,
ritual. There's a ritual. And so you actually grow into this sacred canopy, or grow under this, or are born under, or born into this sacred canopy through story and ritual. And what the sacred stories do is they explain all of life. And the great sacred stories of humanity intend to explain the whole of life. They are total stories. Total stories. In other words, there is no part of your life that kind of squeezes out over on the edges. There's no part of your life that can be lived outside of the sacred story. Can you think of anything in the biblical tradition? That's probably what most of us know. I won't ask you about Buddhist traditions or Hindu traditions or American Indian traditions. Some of you may know something about those things. Any examples of that? Pardon?
Catholicism,
yes, yeah. And just in the biblical tradition in general.
Creation story.
Yeah, sure. Of course, the creation story.
Well, Noah and the flood.
Noah and the flood, right? So you get the creation story. Let's start with that one. We'll go into some of the other ones. The creation story. Everything gets put in there, huh? Each in its own day. And in fact, as we know, in the biblical tradition, in Genesis, there are probably two creation stories kind of put together. Both of them that we say are biblical, the same Hebrew Yahweh. But you know, you remember one of them, the first of the creation stories. Well, do you remember reading it? How does it sound? You don't have to go the exact words, but... In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth. Sounds like...
No.
Could be.
Well,
sounds upon once upon a time.
That's a story.
Or, but it really says in the beginning. In Greek, it's arche. Arch. We get words like arch. In the beginning. In other words, is there anything before the beginning?
Not that we know of.
Not that we know of. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, how's it go? Read a few couple verses, and it'll stimulate our imagination.
In the beginning, God created, also redeemed, by the way, the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and the darkness was upon the face of the deep.
So you have this kind of mysteriness, huh? It's before, there's no sacred canopy there yet.
The Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters.
You know, water. Chaos.
God said, let there be light.
Let there be light. Now, what does that kind of stuff sound like in the beginning? Think about rituals now.
Drama.
Right. You might start out your church service by saying, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Or, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the communion of the Holy Spirit. Or, the Lord be with you. Okay. Come on. So all of a sudden, you know, something has set the stage in the beginning. And so this is kind of the setting of the stage of the drama, of the ritual. Rituals are dramas, aren't they? So there's a certain dramatist in pastors. There has to be a certain dramatist in pastors, and maybe in teachers. And... Go ahead. Read the last little sentence or so that you said.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day.
Next.
And God said, let there be
light. Have you heard those words before? And God said, let there be? What is that? What's going on? You have a ritual, huh? And God said... And God said, and then what does God say? Does God say something different?
Mm-hmm.
Let there be. What, remember that, right? There's a ritual going on there. Let there be.
A firmament.
Something different, but within the ritual.
In the midst of the waters. And let it separate the waters from the waters.
Right. Waters above, waters below.
And God made the firmament and separated the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so.
The only thing that gets outside of the firmament are these waters above, huh?
And God called the firmament heaven. That's confused us for a long time, hasn't it? And there was evening, and there was morning, and a second day.
Oh, have you heard those words?
Mm-hmm.
And there was evening, and there was morning, and a second day. We could do all of them, huh?
Mm-hmm.
There's a ritual, certain ritual going on. Now, most people... A lot of the scholars think that the ritualizing of this story probably took place quite late in Hebrew culture, in the life of the Hebrews. Actually, after the time of the kings, maybe it was going on, but it kind of gets ritualized. When do you need ritual?
Well, When you're away from your own country.
When you're away from your own country.
In Babylonia.
Yeah, that's right. So when they're in Babylonia, huh, and they're saying, how can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? When things are rather chaotic, when they are POWs, prisoners of war, when they don't have much, ritual becomes very important. And so most people think that this particular story of creation was ritualized in order to give them a sacred canopy, even as they are away from their own familiar surroundings. And so this sacred canopy says, even though you're way over there, and the promised land is way over there, there is a sacred story that encompasses both. And don't worry, God's got it all over. Sacred canopies. Well, we could spend a lot of time. It gives meaning to the all of life. And nothing can kind of squeeze outside of the sacred canopy. Can you think of any parts in the Bible when there's some questions about, can anything squeeze outside of the sacred, of God's sacred canopy, of this God and this God's sacred story?
How about the devil in hell?
Okay, can you remember a devil in a hell story, like Job. In the Old Testament? Job. Now, I was thinking about Job. What's that?
Fallen angels. I know where they went to, but they.
Fallen angel story. You have to. Can you think of where fallen angel stories show up in the Bible?
I can't remember.
They don't show up nearly as much as we think. That's one of the reasons nobody can ever remember where they show up.
Tempting of Jesus.
The tempting of Jesus?
The devil there. Yeah, devil in the New Testament.
Right. More Satan and demons in the New Testament. One of the things that I was thinking about is the story of Job. I mean, the story of Job was raising a question. Are some things going on outside of this canopy? And in fact, you have a lot of this kind of canopy talk going on in the book of Job. I don't have the Bible passages that might get my fingertips, and I didn't come kind of prepared to actually look at some of those. We could look at some of those. In fact, one of the things says in Job, God says to Job in the midst of Job's questioning, well, Job, were you around when I stretched out the heavens? When I put the sacred canopy in place? Were you around when I played, when Leviathan, Leviathan was this great primordial monster that was supposed to be, in the deep, symbolizing chaos. And Yahweh says, were you around, Job, when I had Leviathan on a string, and it was kind of like my pet, and I had him tamed? Were you around then? So basically what the book of Job is reaffirming the sacred canopy and pulling in some of these questions of suffering, particularly of suffering and natural disaster, in back under. How about some other ones? Can you think of any other stories in the biblical tradition that kind of either challenge or that pose some kinds of problems to the totality that this sacred story is over the whole of life?
St. Michael's fighting with the devil Moses' body?
Well, there is that. No, I don't think it's actually over Moses' body, but there are some of those kinds of things in intertestamental. But there is St. Michael comes in, mm-hmm. and the angels. Remember what book that comes
and
in?
He's contending for Moses' body.
Well, yeah, and it's really symbolic of contending for the people of Israel. And because Michael is the, well, yeah, this also is, remember what book St. Michael comes in? The archangel St. Michael and all angels do? He does it. Yeah, St. Michael appears in the book of Revelation. Appears first of all in the book of Daniel. Also was one of these Babylonian kind of books written in here in about the year 200 BC. Those kinds of heroes. And there it's thought that that different nations have their own kind of protective angels. And St. Michael was the guardian angel. I was thinking of some, and those are stories that we don't know very well. Most of us don't read them.
How about resurrection?
The resurrection. Good question. I haven't really thought about that. How does the resurrection fit into one of these? I was thinking of Old Testament.
Well, he
how the resurrection, I know that what the resurrection does, I think, is it says there's a whole new canopy going on.
Bigger canopy.
Or, yeah, bigger, or it replaces all these old canopies or something like that. Well, can you think of any contests between God and other gods? Oh, you got the first commandment. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Is it possible to have other gods?
Well, we have Moses and Pharaoh.
Moses and Pharaoh. That's a story of a contesting of two canopies. Whose canopy is the real canopy, or whose canopy covers the totality of life? Ah, snake. Ah, snake. You know, so you've got this contest between the magicians of Egypt, and really what you're having is you have a contest of canopies, sacred canopies. And so, you know, it's like playing cards. Trump yours, ace, ace of clubs. You know, right power if you're playing euchre. So you got the, you got Moses and Pharaoh of Egypt. How about some other ones? How about the prophets of Baal? Great story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Okay, we've got the contest. This is a contest between two, or the story about Balaam's ass and the Baals. But you have this one too. Well, these are all contests between sacred stories. Which one explains more of life, or is the true one, or is over the totality? Well, that's at least one of the facets of sacred canopy, what I call sacred canopy societies. And our most traditional societies are sacred canopy societies. So that they have to do with the totality of life, their story and ritual. Nothing gets out from under them. There's also another facet of sacred canopy societies. There's often in sacred canopy societies, what is natural is socialized. I'll have to explain this a little bit. And conversely, what is social is naturalized. Now, actually, even saying this kind of thing assumes that I'm coming from a modern perspective. Only a modern person would even say these dastardly things. What is natural is socialized. When I was a pastor at Resurrection Lutheran Church in Portland, Oregon, we used to do, we had a drama called Resurrection Players, and we used to do dramas twice a year, big ones. We had a whole group, over 150 people, off and on, were involved in drama, ministry, and things of that sort at our congregation. And one of the ones that the kids really got into was The Sleeping Beauty. And we did the one fall, we did The Sleeping Beauty, so it was 5 months before. And what they were really into in The Sleeping Beauty was what's going on in the sleep, all these kinds of like Grimm's fairy tales. But there's something in the Sleeping Beauty. There's a lot of there's
evil behind it.
Evil. Where does the evil take the best off of? At night, and where else? In the forests. And what kind of forests are these? It's like this forest here. Would you go walking out in the forest? Well, what would be the difference of me walking out here at 10:30 at night, walking down the nature path? What might jump out at me at night?
A
bear. A bear?
A deer.
Chipmunks. What?
An ogre.
An ogre.
That's right.
Aha! Uh-huh. What else besides an ogre?
A coyote.
Would they be coyotes up here? I'm afraid of coyotes. Coyotes, okay. Now, in the Sleeping Beauty, what might jump out? What else?
Live trees.
Witch.
Trees! What else? Why? Because what kind of forest is in the Sleeping Beauty?
Enchanted
forest. What is that?
Magic.
is it? It's scary. Why is it scary? And it's why is it magic or what's that? Why is it? Wait, we use the word enchantment.
Supernatural powers.
Supernatural powers. Well, what's so powerful? What's enchanted? What does enchanted mean? Enchanted. What's that?
Somebody put a spell.
Somebody put a spell. Could be. Yeah, probably. What happens in the it comes alive, isn't it? Actually, it's usually evil, but it's socialized. The plants and the animals, they speak, they move around, they become like society. They're socialized, and animals will speak to you. You have conversations with the animals. Now, they may be scary or they may be friendly.
It's polytheism.
Might be polytheism. It's really not polytheism. Polytheism, they may not be all different gods. Could be, though. Could be.
You look at the Wizard of Oz and they go through.
Wizard of Oz, right? You've got an enchanted forest there. You even have tin men that come alive and lions that speak and that need hearts and, you know, all these kinds of things. The natural world is like the social world. People speak to you, and you have friends, and you have enemies, and even the trees, certain ones are good ones, certain ones are bad ones. Rocks can move around and talk and might roll over you, just kind of, everything seems to have a will of its own, or there's some kind of animation going on. And so often in traditional, in sacred canopy societies, the natural world is rather social. Now, if we had a Native American or American Indians here, we would find out that the natural world is much more social than what most of us probably think about the natural world. In fact, the fact that we actually call it the natural world is kind of that's a modern perspective. We're going to talk about what happens. Well, that's one part of it. And so even in the biblical tradition, you know, where did the Ten Commandments take? On a volcano. Yeah, it's like the volcano speaking. So if you read Exodus 20, you're wondering what's going on. It sounds like being at the foot of Mount St. Helens while it's erupting, and before it actually spoke. You got to keep back, you get people, you know, keep a certain. So that the natural world is socialized. And so you stay more in tune, you actually have more communication, even that word communication, you know, with the natural world. The obverse is also the case. The social world of human beings is naturalized. Now, what might that mean? In sacred canopies, the social world is naturalized. Well, have you ever heard talk? Well, by nature, you should do certain things.
Sort of like my mother was like that. But everything that was social was just, you know, that's the way things are done. That's natural.
It's natural.
Now, you couldn't do it different.
You couldn't do it different. That's exactly right. The social world is naturalized. There are.
Ooh, I'm losing this one all of a sudden. These things come and go.
There's a certain. I don't know if I can spell this. Fixity. There's a certain fixedness to life. There's a certain naturalness to it. There are fixed. Fixed. There are fixed roles and fixed rules. Can you think of a few? Well, you've heard me say this, those of you who have been with me a little bit, once or twice before, in the state of Oregon, in the state of Minnesota, there are two Lutherans running for governor. At least, I think there's probably going to be three Lutherans running for governor. That's a scary thought. and the Republican The person that's put forward by the Republican Party, his name is Al Quist. Yeah, Al Quist. And he has recently said a rather controversial statement. Now, he's actually, interestingly, used a very old sacred canopy factor, and he's actually put it into very modern words. He says that men are genetically predetermined to rule.
Missouri Synod.
No, he's not. He's more conservative than that. That was his, it's been very controversial all over the newspapers, and he's really had to swim upstream on that. Men are genetic. Now, you notice the modern part of it.
Genetics.
He talks about genetics.
Genetics.
In the old days, they would have said
predestined
or just created. By nature. We're created by nature. By nature, men are meant to rule. But now he's made it, he's taken the old social, the social world is naturalized by nature and actually put genes, which is the epitome of nature, aren't they, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
It's not, has nothing to do with our culture, nothing to do with nurture, it's all nature. So you have these nature-nurture debates, huh? This is actually what's going on a lot of times in our society over questions like of sexuality and all kinds of things like that. The nature-nurture debates that are going on. Are we who we are because of our genes, because of our natures? So that in fixed societies, there are fixed rules by nature. By nature, women should have long hair, and by nature, men should have short hair. See? Me too, my children are pointing to how short my hair is. And women should have long hair, should be nice and long. But you should keep it up and not keep it down, and keep it covered. And by nature, you should put a hat on it. And there are those kinds of things even in the biblical tradition.
Yeah.
By nature, certain people are meant to rule, like kings. And so how do you become a king?
Born to it.
Yeah, you're born into it. You have to have certain nurturing, too. It would be helpful. But you're really born into it willy-nilly, and we've had a lot of bad kings over there because, because birth isn't all it's cracked up to be. I mean, genes have their limits.
Yeah.
Nurturing. And so there are fixed roles and fixed rules. We could spend a lot of time on that, huh? I can tell that some of us don't buy this already. These are characteristics of almost all sacred canopy societies.
But who decides what the fixed rules are?
Oh, God, you have to ask that question.
We don't have all afternoon.
In the beginning.
Well, he was.
Whoever told those stories. There are always people that, that lead the ritual.
Priest.
So they write themselves in.
Well, usually, they try to stay, they kind of hide their power and authority. In a certain sense, they do. They usually write themselves in. And so, how did you become a priest in Israel society, Hebraic society? The family. You're born into it. You're born into the priesthood. And you tell a story about why that is the case. Do you remember the story about why Aaron and the Levites are the priests?
Some should do certain things and some should do
other things. But why? What's the explanation?
Moses didn't want to speak. I mean, he was too shy, so Aaron was going to be his mouthpiece.
Yes, Aaron is the mouthpiece, but now why does that continue?
Why is that family?
Why does the family forever have to be the priests?
I don't know.
How do priests make a living?
Well, they lived off of the substance that the others provided. They had their own special village.
Pastors, I've never made an honest wage in my life. I'm somehow living off somebody else's contribution. Now, what about the Levites, the family of Levi? How many tribes were there?
12.
And how many?
Levites was one tribe.
Yeah, the Levites. Yeah. Levi. They came from the tribe of Levi, the Levites. And there were 12 tribes. How many parcels of land was there in the Promised Land?
Probably 11.
11.
Oh, 11. Oh.
Ah, somebody has to live off.
Well, the priests live off like it.
The priests live off everybody else, so that, you know, that's what offerings were all about. And same thing today, no? So yeah, the priests get written into the, actually, so in the story somehow is the explanation about why certain people are priests. I mean, this nothing squeezes out of the sacred stories. Well, what comes on? Well, I mean, sacred stories are not, you know, from that point of view, the biblical heritage is like other sacred stories. All kinds of details are different, but structurally, some of the things are very much the same. And we could spend a lot of time on these fixed roles and fixed rules and all the stories that go into it. Why Israel had kings, you know, and there's this controversy going on. God says, well, you know, okay, I don't want to give you a king. We want kings. God says, okay. You know, reluctantly gives kings. So you have these kind of stories, but God says, you know, you're not going to like it. This isn't going to bode well for you. Well, so why didn't God just say, no? Somehow, God, you don't know that's how the sacred story goes. Well, what happens to these sacred stories? With, what's the other part of today? Science and the sacred.
Science is proving a lot of this wrong.
Yeah, you know.
Contradicts.
Or redefines. Yeah, that's exactly right. There are some people that come around in the West. Now, I'm not talking about the rise of science in other places, but science usually is attached to, at least modern science, and now all over the world, is particularly attached to the West. And although there were all kinds of, I suppose, but they didn't call them sciences in other parts of the world. What goes on in modernity, these scientists? Well, they start off by saying, you know, this one part of the sacred story, way over here on the edge. You know, I can give you a better explanation for why the sun comes up over there and goes like this, says Copernicus. Because the sacred story, the sacred canopy, the Christian sacred canopy said that the earth is here and the sun goes like that. And Copernicus, he didn't want to be a rabble-rouser. He just said, you know, I think that I can give you a better explanation to that. Mm-hmm. And it was rather innocent. But what he didn't realize he was doing, well, it's too late, is he was poking a hole in this canopy right over here, way at the edge. And it had to do with the natural world. And what happened to Copernicus when he did that? He was excommunicated, and his books were banned, and Luther had some bad things to say about it, too. And one of Luther's friends, another theologian of the Reformation, actually wrote an introduction to Copernicus' book, and Luther said, that fool, all you got to do is read the book of Joshua and Judges, you find out that the earth is still... And, you know, then came along this other guy, Copernicus, you know, so we did these four guys. You had Copernicus,
Galileo, and
Kepler,
and Newton,
the big N. And all of these guys come along. What Galileo said is, well, Copernicus was explaining, he was basically right, that the sun is at the center. But it's not exactly, so he made some better observations. He looked at the fact, he had a better instrument. He had better, what we would call today?
Instrumentation,
technology. He had better technology and better measurements. So you know how mathematics and technology. And so he could see different facts. He knew more facts and he knew the facts better. And so he revises. And Galileo gets in trouble too, of course, with the church, and they anathematize him. And Kepler comes along and he revises it even more, and they talk about, you know, it's not circles, it's ellipses and things like that. And so they gradually kind of widen this a little bit. And Newton comes along, he explains why things fall down.
and throws another little nick into the sacred canopy, and it's an avalanche from here on in.
He explained what light, or at least it naturally explained what light was. It could be divided up in things of this nature, which God created light.
Kepler?
No, Newton.
Newton. Right, lots of these guys. There was a great philosopher. The first great, usually is recognized as the first great modern philosopher. You maybe can't see this. His name was Descartes. And Descartes, before he became a philosopher, philosophers were almost always second career folks. And his first career was in optics. And what he was became an expert in his eyes and how eyes work. And he said, do you want to find out why certain people go blind? It's not, well, remember, there's a story in the New Testament, a Jesus story. And they come to Jesus and they say, why is this man blind? Did he sin or did his parents sin?
Right?
Right? Did he sin or did his parents sin? Now, you notice Jesus doesn't answer that question. Wise man, as he went, doesn't answer that question. But do you notice the kind of question that people in a sacred society ask? Mm-hmm. If somebody is screwed up naturally, maybe it's because they screwed up socially. Mm-hmm. They sinned. Descartes says to people, you know, if you want to know why people go blind or their vision goes bad, it's not because God curses them or God blesses other people. It has nothing to do with some kind of special curse of these people because they did something wrong. It's because of these little optic things in there. They just get screwed up somehow. He actually, he also, the other thing that he does that helps, he doesn't really realize how significant it is until Newton comes along, is he is the first person to understand the laws of inertia. And you know, Newton then does things with thermodynamics. But Descartes understands inertia, why things keep going. You know, if you throw a ball, nothing can keep it going until something else, some other thing comes up. I'm not a scientist, so I don't know these laws that well. Well, there's a whole bushel of scientists that come up. I mean, it's one after another. And early on in the West, the sacred canopy starts getting going mostly what we would call the natural world. Nature. And basically, more and more people are explaining more and more things better along some kind of, well, we would call them causal reasoning, causes and effects, natural causes and effects, better than the sacred canopy stories. And what this began to do is it began to weaken the sacred canopy story, particularly at least in the West, in Christianity. Well, you can see what you know the church does. What happens to the Christians? The Christian canopy kind of goes like this all of a sudden. What happened? Part of life starts...
Yeah, they created a study called Natural Philosophy.
Yes.
And all of this is now part of... You go to the university and learn that. You go to theology and learn that.
Ah, yes, 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 you're right. In fact, sacred canopies... Notice the word... University, a universe, city, university, it explains everything. And what happens in the West is, well, you end up with a special discipline, we call it. And this is exactly what happens in modernity. You continue to break things down into smaller and smaller disciplines. So over here, you know, there's the discipline of geology and biology and botany. And they begin to explain more and more of this. Most of it early on takes place in the, as I said, you have all these sciences, these disciplines. And they're called sciences. They're usually called natural sciences. And every time there's a new science created, or somebody says, well, I can explain that better, the sacred canopy kind of gets smaller. It begins to shrink. the incredible shrinking sacred canopy in the West. Well, that, you know, the church doesn't do well. Science and religion, this controversy goes on, and it's because of this kind of thing. Well, what begins happening, let me give you an example of, do you know what disease, or, oh, I already gave away half part of the answer, doggone, I believe that question. What has killed more people in the history of the human race? There you go. A disease, not war. Up until now. This might change rather quickly just because the population of the earth is, you know, so big compared to what it was over the whole history of the human race. But what has killed more people in the history of the human race is a disease. Do you know what disease it is?
Smallpox.
Smallpox, this man knows this story probably. And this is a fun story. How smallpox gets, well, what's happened to smallpox? Are you an MD here?
No.
It's contained in three or four
little vials, huh? Right.
And they're in different cities. One is in Moscow, one is in Washington, and one is in London.
Yes.
I think France has one, too.
Really? Well,
their debate is whether to kill it.
Yes, that is a great debate right now. Why is that a debate? We'll back into the story.
You might need it again.
You might need it again.
You might need it to develop a vaccine.
Might need to develop a vaccine. Well, they actually, you don't develop the smallpox vaccine with smallpox virus. Actually, that's part of the story. It's an interesting story. In the 19th century, or maybe even earlier, there was a part of this is an apocryphal story, and part of it is true. There was a man who went around from village to village, and he was in villages all over in different parts of the world, and these villages all had sacred canopy societies, and the people in the villages were dying of smallpox, and he was kind of curious. He was didn't really have a big scientific method. He was mostly curious, and he interviewed people about, I mean, talked to them about, you know, they're having smallpox, and he would ask them why you have smallpox. And the sacred stories in different parts of the world basically would say, you know, it's the wrath of God, the anger of God, that God, there's some kind of judgment of God going on in one way or another. But then he would say, are there anybody not dying? And they would all say, yes, certain people are blessed. God blesses them. And it was this man kind of discovered, or he just kind of, I think it just kind of dawned on him after going around from village to village, that there was something in common with all these people that couldn't get or didn't get smallpox. You know how this story goes, probably. What was in common about them? A lot of us probably know this. They were all what?
Norwegian.
They were all
Norwegian.
They were all girls, women. And for one reason or another, maybe they were the runt of the literature. They had all had one the runt of the litter. They had all had one chore as children:
milking cows.
And that's all they knew early on. They didn't know anything else. This guy made the connection between milking cows and not getting smallpox. You have to realize, you know, smallpox is the most deadly disease that's ever hit unity. It's ever hit humans. And so he makes this connection with milking cows, and that's all he knows. And in the 19th century, they finally discover that what these people had, these children, mostly girls, had received was
cowpox.
And they still didn't know anything about immunization but they did make the connection. If you got cowpox, you couldn't get smallpox. So what you try to do is, you know, expose as many people to cowpox as possible, and then you didn't get smallpox. Smallpox is both very deadly and very infectious because it's on your extremities. Well, in the latter part of the 19th century, there was a brilliant, great medical discovery, probably one of the greatest medical discoveries of all times. Not yet. Because in order to have penicillin and all these kinds of things like vaccines, you have to have what? It's another piece of technology. You have to have what's that called?
Syringe.
They figured out how to get something outside, inside your skin without having to take it through your mouth or your nose or something like that. And so they figured out how to put smallpox And then also they eradicated smallpox later on in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And it was a tremendous, I think, social miracle. One of the reasons the story is interesting for me is because it happens to be a Lutheran that headed up the smallpox eradication. So the smallpox went the way of the dinosaur, except for these three little vials, because the environment, the only environment that smallpox virus can live in, is the human environment. And they did the story on that is really an amazing kind of story, especially how they worked it in India and other places. A guy named Bill Fagan, who is a Lutheran pastor's kid up here in the Pacific Northwest, and now he turned out to be the head of the Center of Disease Control, and now directs the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia, President Carter's Center. What happens in modernity is people start moving gradually to explaining the sciences of nature, and then all of a sudden they turn to the sciences of society. So they first of all desocialize the natural world, who says it doesn't happen this kind of way, it happens with causes and effects, causal reasoning, and then they turn their eyes onto the social world. And they start to create new sciences, like the science of society. Now, there had always been political science, but now they start also not only the political, political philosophy becomes political science, and you also then have the social sciences.
The psychology. And
yeah. Now, the first one you get is sociology. In other words, you explain soologies, luggies, the science of society. We'd have to spend a lot more time. When that happens, it happens right after the French Revolution in the latter part of the 18th century and things like that. But each time they do this, they poke another hole into the sacred canopy. You want to know why certain people rule? Well, don't ask the sacred canopy story. Look at, you know, the theories behind divine right of kings and all kinds of things like that. So you begin to poke holes into all these, and the sacred canopy keeps shrinking. And into the 20th century, the canopy had shrunk a whole lot. Remember yesterday, for those of you who are here, I had a public world and a private world. By the 20th century, the sacred canopy had shrunk way over to here, primarily. So that the sacred stories had to do less and less with the public world, with nature, with society, and I'll get into tomorrow when I talk about power and money. I'll talk a little bit more about some of this differentiation. And so the sacred canopy had been way over here in the private world until the beginning of the 20th century, and this very famous guy comes on the scene, and he says, aha! You think that? I can explain. Well, I should put it up here. No, I'll put it down here. What's that word that Susan Brill was asking for pronunciation yesterday? P-C-K? P-C-K. P-C-K. Do you think of any words that start with P-S? C. K. That's the Greek word. So, and what had happened is Christianity said, well, I can explain, if we can't explain this other thing, we can at least explain the soul. That's what the word means. Psyche means soul. Until this guy came along and says, huh, I can explain the psyche. This guy came out of a sacred canopy tradition and had deserted it. And his name was?
Sigmund Freud.
And so he wrote a book about religion, and the title of his book about religion is called The Future of an illusion. And he said, I can explain the psyche scientifically. I can give you causes and effects. And it was a very dynamic understanding of the psyche. He said there are basically three parts to it. There's an id, has to do with our passions. And there's a
ego.
It's kind of our I, or our me. And actually, this was a very old definition. It went way back to Aristotle, at least this much of it. This is, in Aristotle, human beings were rational animals. Animals with reason. Your id is your irrational appetites and, you know, lust and power and greed and irascibleness and things. Ire, anger, that's in the other, it's down here. So what he put on was what religion had done before. Religion had been your, some people would kind of call it the conscience or something like that. He called it, it's a bad thing to call it the superego. We really should call it the, in German it would be better called the transego. The transego. Those are the transego. Superego, it's above, but it's the trans-ego, it's our overall ego, it's our overall I, it's the we in our life, or as they popularized it a few years later when they talked about transactional analysis, it's our parents. It's what we would call our heritage. It's the stories that have formed us, the sacred stories. Right, and there's this great fight in. One of the nice things about Freud is he realized that this is a conflictual model. These things are all in conflict with one another. And it is kind of the ego is kind of the peacemaker between these two. Kind of keeps your superego without dominating your life and oppressing it and repressing all your kinds of ids that come up. And you can go into a lot of that kind of thing. But he really discovered history, social history. That human beings are not just reasonable animals, but we have a social history. We have memory, and it has to do with our sociality. A couple more minutes. And so what he did is he took a huge chunk out of the Christian and Jewish and other sacred canopy, and the canopy got so small. In fact, if you don't have the soul anymore, what do you got left? Well, maybe not even anything. I mean, he claimed that there's nothing. This is all just an illusion. And how Christianity responds to this kind of thing is, well, you went into the CPE movement, clinical pastoral education. Your pastors had to go study psychology because the sacred canopy is not good enough anymore. In fact, the sacred canopy isn't very good at all, so you learn all these psychologies. And when I do this with pastors, you know, they all chuckle and laugh. The CPE began to wag the seminary dogs.
The sin got explained away.
What's that?
Sin got explained away.
Yeah, whatever. So Menninger, a psychologist, interestingly enough, wrote a book called Whatever Became of Sin. In fact, that's exactly what Freud wants to get rid of, notions of sin and morality. And to give us, in fact, a science. Nowadays, we hardly talk about sin either in churches. We talk about illnesses or addictions. Those are all medical models, all science models, interestingly enough. And so now, if you want to write a book, what we're realizing is that the sacred canopy has shrunk so far. This happens to pastors and their identities, too. You can kind of see the priest, the identity of the priest. Notice? There was a time when the priest was overall, and then gradually becomes smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. You want to know why nobody wants to be a pastor anymore? Because the hat that we wore has gotten too small. And so people like me went out and we learned psychology. And we learned sociology.
You think of the Pope, what the Pope's trying to do with all this. I mean, the Pope's giving all these rules that say to steal this.
Yes, right. Exactly. Right now, what's going on is a fight now over the sacred canopy. And some people say what happened was, well, science also has a sacred canopy, just doesn't admit it.
Exactly.
You thought I'd never say it, right?
Right. Well, that's
the new sacred canopy of our society, that science is going to explain everything.
Yes. So now...
But I think religion is poking holes in that. Or
yes, right. We write books. You want to sell a book nowadays, put the title Spirituality in it.